doesn't matter what I do. Wanting you is almost tragic. I couldn't stop if I wanted to.
From The Faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
I want to start today with something many of you have been writing to me about, and it's the question, essentially, if Joe Biden doesn't run for re-election, do Democrats have any good candidates for 2024, particularly to run against Donald Trump if he's the nominee, or Ron DeSantis if he's the nominee? Now, why are we contextualizing this with Trump and DeSantis? Well, because they're the only two polling anything even remotely viable in every CPAC straw poll and Republican opinion poll. It's Trump leading, and then Ron DeSantis with between 10 and 22%, depending on the poll or straw poll that you look at. Everybody else is in the low single digits. So at least for now, let's theorize that it will be or is likely to be Donald Trump or Ron DeSantis in 2024. Now, I've already said before, it's unclear if Joe Biden is going to run for re-election. The language being used by the White House is very narrow. When Jen Psaki is asked questions like if Joe Biden plans to run, why hasn't he announced or filed or whatever? And she'll say Joe Biden has the intention of running for re-election, which is a very specifically worded phrase. I think they just don't know if Joe Biden's going to run for re-election, or they may know he's not going to. And then the question becomes, well, so then what? And much of this is wrapped up with how the midterm elections go. Much of this connects to the continued and obvious efforts that the right is going to make to take the election, whether they win it or not. And unfortunately, it's not looking very good. I think it would be an obvious lie if I said to you, there's a great bullpen right now. There's all sorts of great people. First of all, if Biden does run for re-election against Trump, I don't see that going well for Biden. And I've explained before that one of the reasons for that is so far Biden's presidency, although there is no doubt that there have been a number of tangible successes, which I outlined last week, maybe the week before, it has not been an interesting presidency in the sense of inspiring people. Joe Biden's approval has been trickling down. And it seems to me that Donald Trump, if he was the nominee against Joe Biden, would be able to sort of reinvigorate a lot of the same people on whose vote he won in 2016. I don't see that going particularly well. I am unsure about Biden versus DeSantis, but unfortunately, DeSantis is almost like a more competent Trump, which can be very dangerous. So then the immediate conversation becomes, if not Biden, what about Kamala Harris? It would be natural in some sense that there would sort of be a primary, but really that if it's not Biden, the DNC would kind of anoint Kamala Harris as the de facto nominee. That seems very problematic. Kamala Harris's current approval or favorability is 39%, and that's lower than every recent vice president, and some by a lot. At this point in time, this was taken at day 378. Mike Pence was more popular and more liked than Kamala Harris. Joe Biden was more popular and more liked than Kamala Harris as vice president. Dick Cheney was significantly more favorably seen than Kamala Harris. And Al Gore was dramatically more favorably seen than Kamala Harris. So the numbers don't look great for Kamala Harris right now. It looks like a very uphill battle if it's going to be Harris versus Trump or Harris versus Ron DeSantis. So that doesn't look good. Then there was this idea of bring Hillary Clinton back. Now, I already talked about why I think that's not a good idea. I think it can't possibly go well. And there are a number of different reasons. One is that Hillary Clinton never really inspired the type of energy that I think is necessary, particularly running against a reinvigorated Trumpian electorate. And even if it's DeSantis, it will still be a Trumpian electorate. DeSantis is a sort of Trump, although now they are publicly feuding. Trump and DeSantis are. The electorate is quite similar. So then you've got the people saying, well, Bernie's the guy. It's finally Bernie's time. I'm not going to blow smoke anywhere. To me, Bernie's time is done. Bernie ran twice. He would be 83 at the time of inauguration. If the idea is that there needs to be more energy than Biden, although I agree that Bernie has more energy than Biden, it's not seeming to me like the guy who already lost twice is going to be the guy who at 83 is going to come in and, you know, blow the top off the electorate and defeat Trump or DeSantis. If you have evidence and data that suggests it could be Bernie, let me know. I'm willing to be told I'm wrong, but it's not seeming great. Then you've got the AOC crowd. People say AOC has the energy. She has the likability. That's true. AOC has a lot of energy. AOC would be old enough to be president by 2 months. Roughly 2.5 months, something like that, at the time of the next inauguration. It's not seeming plausible to me that 34-year-old AOC successfully runs on the basis that I'll be old enough by 2 months on inauguration day. that doesn't seem to me like the recipe for a success. I'm just being realistic with you. I read something about Amy Klobuchar. Tons of people hate Amy Klobuchar. She never polled more than 6 in 2020. But I have to tell you, Klobuchar to me sounds less crazy than Harris or Hillary in the context of 2024. Now, Perry Bacon Jr. wrote a piece in The Washington Post talking about, among other people, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, a white male Democrat, but from the South and a governor rather than a senator. Which sometimes can be more appealing to people in different parts of the country, the South, the Midwest, et cetera. It's an interesting idea. I don't know much about Andy Beshear, so I'll sort of put a pin in that. But that's something Perry Bacon Jr. wrote about. Now, Perry Bacon Jr. also writes about Tim Kaine, who ran alongside Hillary in 2016. It is difficult to imagine a less exciting and more milquetoast candidate than Tim Kaine. I feel almost embarrassed to even mention the idea of Tim Kaine as the nominee. It's very tough to imagine that's the direction. So I don't see any strong candidates right now. A few things I will mention on rhetoric. And what I mean by that is, in terms of being able to mix it up with people effectively in media and in debates, and come up with sort of like snappy comebacks and optics, there's something interesting about Pete Buttigieg. But he's already suffered and been the target of significant character assassination in his role as Secretary of Department of Transportation. Secretary of Transportation, you don't typically see that Secretary of Transportation into presidential candidate. It's unclear what his fate would be. So I'm just not sure about it. And then it has to be said that on policy, Elizabeth Warren is one of the most left candidates of anybody who's recently run other than Bernie. Her wealth tax proposal is something to the left of what most Democratic candidates have proposed. But on a personality level, the country really does not seem to like Elizabeth Warren. So that doesn't seem particularly good either. So it's a very tough situation. Let's get through the midterms insofar as what happens will inform what the dynamics of 2024 might be. But I am not particularly optimistic about the farm team right now. I'm open to having my mind changed. Let me know what you think. This is crazy to say, but courts around the country, courthouses, are bracing for violence as a result of Donald Trump now being under 3 criminal investigations. It almost sounds surreal. What? Courts are bracing for violence because Trump is being, how could that be? Well, yes, it is 2022, and that's the reality that we live in. I have an article from a Business Insider. Trump is facing criminal investigations into his conduct. Courts are bracing for violence and chaos. Donald Trump encouraged supporters to protest where he and his company are under investigation. Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis and other officials aren't taking his comments lightly. Officials in New York, Atlanta, and Washington, D.C. are investigating whether Trump broke the law. These cities are taking Trump at his word and preparing for the worst. In Atlanta, Fannie Willis requested that the FBI assess the security of Fulton County Courthouse and other government buildings. I'm asking that you immediately conduct a risk assessment and you provide protective resources. One big reason for concern around Trump is simply his presence in a courthouse. A case or cases of this magnitude would likely draw big crowds. This would mean more work for law enforcement and Secret Service. We have the video, of course, of Trump at his recent rally actually saying there should be major protests depending on what happens with these investigations.
If these radical, vicious, racist prosecutors do anything wrong or illegal, I hope we are going to have in this country the biggest protest we have ever had in Washington, D.C., in New York, in Atlanta, and elsewhere, because our country and our elections are corrupt.
Now, understand that the code of what he's saying, when he says, if they do anything illegal and corrupt to me in those places. But what he's really saying is, if they do anything, I will tell you that it is illegal and corrupt. If there are any charges brought forward out of New York, out of Atlanta, out of Washington, D.C., at the federal level, what he's going to say that it is corruption and that it is illegal. And he is already ginning up exactly the type of violence that we saw on January 6th. So on the one hand, when we say courts bracing for violence, what? Courts brace? Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Someone facing criminal charges and the court system has to physically brace for violence. Well, yeah, look at what happened on January 6th. In fact, we almost need to fortify the court buildings because we can't count on it all being dealt with appropriately outside those buildings because of what we saw on January 6th. I mean, hopefully it would be different. Hopefully in Atlanta or in New York, it would be handled differently. And knowing what happened on January 6th, they would be prepared. But it's a real and crazy thing that this is being discussed. The far right is sort of being worked up into a lather of seething anger at someone for all of the things and injustices that they perceive to have been carried out against them. And there are certainly injustices that have been carried out against the average person. When we talk about the two justice systems we have, when we talk about our economic system allowing and even causing such inequality and disenfranchisement, of course, but their ire is being pointed at the wrong place, at election systems that are supposedly fraudulent, at investigative systems that are supposedly targeting Trump with the so-called witch hunts. They are being told something's going to have to be done, but it always ends up being a cynical use of these people by Trump, either for their money or, as we saw on January 6th, for their, it's almost like for their freedom. They traded their freedom for Trump when he said, let's go to the Capitol, and more than 700 of them now facing criminal charges. So this is a keg that could very well explode. Now, I think it's important to mention one additional thing. I fear a rise in violence regardless of what happens to Trump. And what I mean by that is Trump in and of himself is not the root cause of the weaponized xenophobia and disinformation and authoritarian leaning. He identified it as a good way to wrap up this electorate that was to some degree made up of people that were not really even following politics up until Trump swooped in and said, hey, here's how you can get involved and help me rise to power. I worry that those people are plausibly going to become violent over the next couple of years, even without it being Trump directing them to go to courthouses and cities where he is potentially facing charges, which, again, I still don't think is the most likely outcome. I think that there's a propensity here for violence regardless. And that's a really scary thing. If you disagree with me, let me know. You can find me on Twitter at D. Pacman. The David Pacman Show depends on the support of our audience to fund what we do, including most recently sending correspondents around the country to interview people at different events like we did in Conroe, Texas at the Trump rally a couple of weeks ago. You can sign up at joinpacman.com. One of the great membership benefits is the bonus show. And as I am now telling people, if Alex Jones hates the bonus show this much, it must be pretty interesting. Oh, now I don't have my file. I meant to play my file and now it's gone. Okay. Anyway, Alex Jones hates the bonus show. And so that should at least make you sort of curious about it. You can sign up at joinpacman.com. You can use the coupon code WOW22 to get a discount off of your membership. Okay. The latest development in the Joe Rogan Spotify controversy is that the CEO of the Trump-affiliated right-wing social media platform Rumble has offered Rogan $100 million to leave Spotify and to bring his show to Rumble. There's a very short and straightforward Reuters report about this. Rogan gets $100 million offer from Trump-affiliated site Rumble. Rumble Inc., a YouTube-style website popular among U.S. conservatives, has offered Joe Rogan $100 million over 4 years for all his shows. Days after the podcaster apologized for using racial slurs in his content, Rogan is facing backlash for COVID misinformation on his program hosted on Spotify. Neil Young and Joni Mitchell pulled their content from the platform. The incidents prompted Spotify to add a content advisory to any episode featuring discussion of COVID, as scientists and medical professionals urged the platform to prevent Rogan from spreading falsehood. So this CEO wrote to Rogan. Chris Pavlovsky is the CEO of Rumble, and wrote, "Dear Joe, we stand with you, your guests, and your legion of fans in desire for real conversation. So we'd like to offer you 100 million reasons to make the world a better place. How about you bring all your shows to Rumble, both old and new, with no censorship for 100 million bucks over 4 years? This is our chance to save the world. And yes, this is totally legit." So there's a couple different things here, I think, that are important to talk about. First and foremost, there's a reality that more than likely Joe Rogan can't just do this because he's under contract with Spotify. If Spotify pulled his show, they'd probably still have to pay him. Even if they released him from the contract, they might still have to give him something if he had some other thing. You know, we don't know the exact details of the contract, so it's like an offer Rumble can make that's very unlikely to become a real thing because of how these contracts tend to work. And I say that without actually having looked at Joe Rogan's contract. But my concern here is as follows. And many of you know that, number one, I've been on Rogan's program twice. And when I was on, no topic was off limits, and I said whatever I wanted to, and Rogan seemed completely open to listening to what I had to say, and in a serious, you know, and genuine way. And since then, I have not held back at criticizing Joe Rogan when he has engaged in spreading COVID disinformation, either through things he says or things his guests say that remain unchallenged. We lampooned his bizarre interview with Jordan Peterson. Like, I've not held back at all. I know that some of my progressive elements of my progressive cohort have held back. And I don't know why. It might be they don't want to maybe lose future access to Rogan. Like, as I've said, he may have no idea about the things I've been saying, and he might have me back on if I said, "Hey, I'm going to be down in Austin and I'd love to be on." Or he might never speak to me again. I have no idea. I've not exchanged any messages with Rogan for a while. I just call it like I see it. And on the recent stuff, I do think that the things that are being uncovered that Rogan said are absolutely horrible and disgusting. And I also believe that his apology was sincere, to the extent that I don't believe that deep down he is trying to spread disinformation. I think he gets lulled into it through something that we might call kind of like audience capture and guest capture. The circle that he's in, and it's like, you know, there's people who are going to say this is too harsh a critique, and people who will say I'm being too easy on Rogan. I think the reality is that while Rogan has shown himself to be significantly open-minded for a long time, Rogan is in a circle that is very culturally conservative, and that culturally conservative circle includes race-based jokes that I find completely gross, and it also includes certain ideology when it comes to government regulation and COVID and the like. I mean, the guy has said he has seen the wacky Texas governor Greg Abbott personally since he has moved to Texas. Abbott's completely out of his mind, and Rogan, from what I've heard, acts like Greg Abbott is a reasonable, normal person to be listening to. So there's both the audience of Rogan skews culturally conservative, and in addition to that, he's in these culturally conservative circles, which makes it so that he has more right-wing guests than left-wing guests. Now, there's a list that has been spreading of Rogan's right-wing guests versus left-wing, and the right-wing list is much longer. The right-wing list is much longer. At the same time, there were some notable people missing from the left-wing guests that he has had on. Me, for example, I wasn't on that list. I've been on twice. So I think with all of these, no one thing really tells us everything about this story, but the real concern I have is he's already in a sort of right-wing echo chamber because he has gone to Texas and he's hanging out with Greg Abbott and all these other people. because he is getting the most positive feedback from the right wing, who says his racial comments are perfectly fine, his COVID comments are perfectly fine. And so the concern is it's only going to get worse. And I think it's unlikely that Spotify is going to drop him at this point in time. And from a very practical perspective, one of the worst things I can imagine is the show just getting more right wing. That seems like it would be a bad thing. So that's my general perspective on this at this point in time. The things that Rogan has said are completely indefensible. And he doesn't seem to be defending them. And there is questions as to whether the apology is sincere or not. I mean, of course, that question can sort of always be asked. But at this point, the worst thing, given the size of his podcast, is for it to become more of a right wing echo chamber. He should be held to what he said he would do, which is to have more people on with views based on the accepted science on COVID. And he should be held to that, period. End of story. Hey, this is a really strange video. Yesterday, radical Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, visibly struggling to breathe on the floor of the House, ranted about mask. Now, you might be saying, David, hold on. Are you saying mask or masks? I'm saying mask. She was ranting about mask. I don't know why she was saying mask singular. She was. Everything about this video is very, very strange. And look at the amount of disinformation she packs into just a 90-second rant.
Georgia, seek recognition.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to address the House about how children feel about masks.
Gentlelady will suspend.
How children feel about mask. What?
The gentlelady is seeking unanimous consent
to address the House for 1 minute.
Without objection, gentlelady is recognized.
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, I'd like to talk about how children feel about masks.
What? Now, I know that a lot of the stuff she does is her accent. And people say, David, you shouldn't really talk about that. Like when she says mental as opposed to mental, that's her accent. But does that include, I want to talk about how children feel about mask? That doesn't seem like an accent. That just seems bizarre.
You see, while they're watching television, seeing Super Bowl games where adults are filling stadiums without mask.
Why is she out of breath? I mean, just none of it makes sense.
Join themselves while they see concerts happen. They see people go to work. They see adults going many places all over this country without mask. They are forced to wear masks every single day at school.
they are forced to wear masks, all of them.
And it's wrong. Actually, it's child abuse. Now, I know that sounds like strong words, but it really is, because children are not at risk of COVID-19.
Now, that is a lie. That is a lie. The truth about kids and COVID is that when the pandemic started, it did seem kids were less likely to contract it. Remember, that was the big thing. And that if they did, they had mild illness. But as the pandemic has progressed, that has changed. It's still true that most kids will have only mild symptoms, but most people who get COVID have mild symptoms. We are seeing more and more children's hospitals across the country with surges in pediatric COVID hospitalizations. We have seen some specific conditions that are side effects of COVID that seem to almost only affect children. So it's very much this whole thing about kids don't have to worry about COVID is very much untrue.
Children are at the lowest risk. But do you know what's harmful to children? Having their faces covered all day long at school, not being able to see each other's faces, not being able to see their teachers' faces, not being able to learn properly speech, emotions, and having that connection, seeing each other's faces and learning from adults, seeing each other's faces.
This is sort of like you didn't read the book and all of a sudden the teacher calls on you to tell us what was in yesterday's 20 pages that we were assigned. Like this, she seems very unprepared for this in more ways than just the heavy breathing.
Now, while Democrats are going on with the mask for thee and not for me, kids have had enough and they're going to be future voters. and they are sick and tired of being forced to wear masks. It needs to end. Masking children is child abuse.
Now, of course, masking children is not child abuse, but anybody who's been paying attention knows that the masking is ending. First of all, the kids don't really seem to mind the masks that much. I think I mind the masks more than the kids, to be perfectly frank. But the masking is ending. The masking is ending. We've heard from New Jersey that they're going to end the masking in schools. California is moving in that direction. New York is talking about it. We're clearly moving, rightly or wrongly, into the endemic phase of how we are accounting for this virus. And the masking is ending. And again, why is she out of breath? Why is she saying mask singular? We may never know. You can see this clip if you're just listening today. We'll have this clip up on our Instagram, which you can find at David Pakman Show. It's great to welcome back to the program Johan Hari, who is a writer and journalist whose latest book is Stolen Focus, Why You Can't Pay Attention and How to Think Deeply Again. Johan, always great speaking with you.
Hey, David, I was saying to you before we went on air, it's really weird whenever I talk to you because you're like a voice in my head that I listen to so much that it always feels slightly surreal when I'm then interacting with that voice. But it's lovely to be with you.
Always, always good to talk to you. And this is a really timely book. We first should start with, what is the case to be made for this lack of attention and lack of focus? Because there are some who say this is a very popular story to talk about, but there's really no evidence that there is a focus or attention problem at this point in time. So first question is, how do we quantify that this really is a problem?
I used to say exactly what those people say, that, you know, every generation struggles with attention and nothing unusual is happening now. And I started to write Stolen Focus because I noticed that something really weird seemed to be happening to my own attention. With each year that passed, things that required deep focus, like reading a book, having deep conversations, watching a long movie, things that are very deep to my sense of self, were getting harder and harder. They were getting more and more like running up a down escalator. You know what I mean? Like, I could still do them, but they were getting harder. Mm-hmm. And I told myself, well, this is just aging, right? But then I was particularly worried about a lot of the young people in my life, a lot of whom seem to be kind of whirring at the speed of Snapchat when nothing still or serious could touch them. And I decided, okay, I'm going to look into the science of this. I'm going to use my training in the social sciences at Cambridge University to investigate this, to see what's happening. And even very early on, some of the facts about this were quite startling. The typical American office worker now focuses on any one task for only 3 minutes. For every one child who was identified with serious attention problems when I was seven, there's now 100 children who've been identified with that problem. So I want to understand, of course, there's many complicating factors going on there. I want to understand, well, what could be happening? So I went on a really big journey all over the world. I researched this for 3 years. I interviewed the leading experts on focus and attention from Moscow to Miami to Melbourne, over 200 of them, and did a really deep dive into their research. And what I learned from them is that there's scientific evidence for 12 factors that can make your attention better or can make it worse. And loads of the factors that can make your attention worse have been significantly rising in recent years. Let's give a real no shit Sherlock obvious example. We sleep 20% less than we did a century ago. And sleep is essential for focus and attention. When you're sleeping, your brain is repairing, it's cleaning itself, it's healing. If you don't do that, your brain is literally clogged up and it's harder to pay attention. Dr. Charles Sizler, arguably the leading expert on sleep in the world, he's at Harvard Medical School, said to me, even if nothing else had changed, even if the only thing that had changed is that we sleep so much less than we did in the recent past, that alone would be causing a very serious attention crisis. But actually, there's many factors beyond that. And what I learned is when you look at these bigger factors, what you realize is your attention didn't collapse. Your attention's been stolen from you by these very big and powerful forces. And once you understand that, it opens up a very different set of ways that together we can begin to get our brains back.
One of the ones that's often mentioned is very generally social media. And I think that that's just not really precise enough from the research I've done. And tell me if this coincides with the research you did. Really, what's at issue in a lot of these things, and it's particularly notable with social media, is rapidly changing focus from one topic to another. Rapid fire, and that creates the expectation of that continuing, and it makes it, it's sort of like you're not exercising the muscle of thinking and focusing on one thing for an extended period of time. Is that the underlying reason why the social media piece is often mentioned?
I think as you so often do, David, you've brilliantly homed in on a more complex and nuanced thing. You're absolutely right. We tend to think of it as, oh, it's just social media did this to us. The answer is much more complicated, and you've gone to one aspect of the complication. So to talk first about that one that you've just raised, which is really important. This started to become clear for me when I went to MIT to interview one of the leading neuroscientists in the world, a man named Professor Earl Miller. And he said to me, look, there's one thing you've got to understand about the human brain more than anything else. You can only consciously think about one or two things at the same time. That's it. This is a fundamental limitation of the human brain. It has not changed in 40,000 years. It's not going to change on any time scale any of us are going to see. You can only think about one or two things at a time. But what's happened is we've fallen from mass delusion. The average American teenager now believes they can follow six or seven forms of media at the same time. So what scientists do, and there's an enormous amount of research on this, is they get people into labs, younger and older people, and they get them to think they're doing more than one thing at a time. And what they discover is invariably you're not doing more than one thing at a time. What you're doing is you're juggling very rapidly between tasks. You're juggling from one thing to another to another. And it turns out when you do that, it always incurs a cost, a psychological cost. The technical term for it is the switch cost effect. So when you try and do more than one thing at a time, you will do all the things you're trying to do less competently. You'll make more mistakes. You'll remember less of what you do. You'll be less creative. And I remember when Professor Miller first explained that to me, obviously I then did a huge amount of research into the literature on this, thinking, okay, I sort of get that, but this must be a small effect. The evidence is quite shocking on this. I'll give you an example of one very small study that's backed by a wider body of evidence. Hewlett-Packard, the printer company, got a scientist in to study their workforce. And this scientist split some of their workers into two groups. And one group was told, just get on with your task, whatever it is, and you won't be interrupted. And the second group was told, get on with your task, whatever it is, and you're going to have to also answer a heavy load of email and phone calls. So basically the way most of us live now. And at the end of it, they gave an IQ test to both groups. The group that had not been interrupted scored on average 10 IQ points higher than the group that had been interrupted. Hmm. Give you a sense of how big that is. If you and me got stoned together now, David, if we smoked a fat spliff, our IQs would go down in the short term by 5 points.
Right.
So being chronically interrupted is twice as bad, at least in the short term, there's a debate about the longer term for cannabis, than being chronically distracted. Well, to give you another study, there's one study that found just receiving 8 text messages in an hour reduces your brain power for the main thing you're trying to focus on by 30%. I would argue most of us are losing that 30% most of the time. That's why Professor Miller said to me, at the moment, we're living in what he called a perfect storm of cognitive degradation as a result of all these interruptions.
To what degree is this sort of like, you know, you stop lifting weights for a while and you lose the muscle, but then you can pick it back, you know, assuming your health is suitable for it, you pick the weights back up and you get the muscle back. To what degree is all of this a question of the right habits and practices that can be regained? And to what degree does it not seem that way?
So the evidence on this is pretty clear. You can get a little bit better at it, but not much, right?
Wow.
There's just a limit to what your brain can do. Like Professor Miller said, this is just a fundamental limitation. Some people are slightly better at it than others. If you really put effort in, you can get slightly better. But the switch cost effect is, as Professor Miller puts it, a textbook level truism, right?
Oh, no. So I don't mean the switch. I mean developing the focus again.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry, I misunderstood you.
Yeah, your answer is more scary in that context.
Well, no, I'm sorry. There you go. More optimistic answer there. Oh, there is a huge number of things we can do to get our focus back.
Okay.
And I think we've got to tackle this at two levels, right? With all of the 12 causes that are damaging our attention and focus, which includes some aspects of our technology, but go way beyond it, from the food we eat to the hours we work, there's a huge array of factors that are pouring acid on our attention. But in terms of whether it can get better, I think there's, for all of these factors, with one exception, there's two levels at which we've got to respond. So the first is personal. There are all, I think of it as sort of defense and offense, right? There are all sorts of things we can do to defend ourselves and our children from these factors that are invading our attention, and I go through dozens of them. If you think about switching, which is one of the causes, give you an example. You can't see this because it's behind my laptop, but in the corner over there, I have something called a K-safe, a promise you I'm not getting commercial sponsorship for these guys. I keep plugging them. A K-safe is a plastic safe. You take off the lid, you put in your phone, you put on the lid, you turn the dial, and it will lock away your phone between 5 minutes and a whole day.
Yes.
I will not sit down and watch a film with my partner unless we both imprison our phones. I won't have dinner with my friends unless we all imprison our phones. So that's one example of dozens that I give of a personal intervention. But I want to be really honest with people, and I think your audience is unusually well fitted to understand this point. These individual tweaks are hugely important. I'm passionately in favor of them. They will really help, but they will only get you so far. Because this is a systemic problem, right? At the moment, it's like someone is pouring itching powder over us all day, and then they're leaning forward and going, hey buddy, you might want to learn how to meditate, then you wouldn't scratch so much. To which the logical response is, screw you, I'll learn to meditate, but we need to stop you destroying my, you know, pouring this itching powder over.
The way
Professor Joel Nigg, one of the leading experts on children's attention problems, put it to me is we need to ask if we're currently living in what he called an attentional pathogenic environment, an environment in which everyone's attention is being degraded, or pretty much everyone's. And if that's the case, then the primary set of solutions we have to pursue are environmental. We have to, together as a movement, take on the forces that are doing this to us.
Yeah, when I've spoken to Cal Newport about this, and you know, his concept is that of deep work. And you know, he talks about at the individual level, maybe when you're actually doing work that's not email based, you don't have your email open in another window. That's like that's one thing. But if your employer expects that you're responding to emails within 10 minutes, then it's not really something that at the personal level is going to set you up for success.
No, you've put that brilliantly. And there is a collective solution to this that I've seen in practice. This is why I'm profound. Although Cal Newport is a good writer, gives good advice, I'm very uncomfortable with a lot of this, because a lot of it, like my K-safe, right? That I mentioned, the thing that imprisons my phone. I use that for 4 hours a day. And I'm conscious that when lots of people hear that, they're going to go, well, screw you, I can't do that, right? How could I possibly do that? That's not a kind, liberating piece of self-help advice. That's a taunt to people who can't do it. So there's a solution to this. In France, in 2018, they had a big crisis of what they called le burnout, which I don't think I need to translate. And the French government, under pressure from labor unions, and they would never have done it without pressure from organized labor, set up a government inquiry to figure out, well, what the hell's going on? Why is everyone so burned out? And one of the things they discovered is that 35% of French workers felt they could never stop checking their phones or checking their email when they were awake, because their boss could message them at any time of the day or night. And if they didn't answer, they'd be in trouble, right? So I can give them all the lovely Cal Newport advice in the world. They can't do it, right? They just can't do it. So the French government, again, I stress labor union pressure was crucial, introduced a legal reform. It's called the right to disconnect. Every French worker now has two rights. Your work hours have to be defined in your contract, and you have the legal right to never answer your phone or check your email when your work hours are over. So it's Paris, obviously, before the plague, to interview people about this. You know, when I was there, Rentokil, the pest control company, was fined 70,000 euros for trying to get one of their workers to check his email an hour after he left work. Now, you can see how, and there are dozens of these collective reforms we need to fight for, you can see how that's a collective reform that sets people free to make the individual reforms that many of them want to make. And there's dozens of these collective reforms, whether it's dealing with the food industry, because the food we are eating at the moment is profoundly damaging our focus and attention, or whether it's dealing with the specific aspects of our technology, which is not all of our technology, and it's not inherent to our technology, that are damaging our attention. And so I argue in the book that just like we needed, and of course still need, a feminist movement for women to reclaim their bodies and their lives, I argue we need an attention movement to reclaim our minds. And it requires a big shift in focus, because at the moment, what I did when I couldn't pay attention is I blamed myself. I was like, there's something wrong with me, right? Why am I not strong enough? Why isn't my willpower good enough? But when you realize this is happening, this is a systemic problem, a structural problem that requires systemic solutions, you realize, well, what's the only thing that solves systemic problems? It's movements. We need an attention movement to reclaim our minds. And I would argue it requires a shift in consciousness. We are not medieval peasants begging at the court of King Zuckerberg for a few little crumbs of attention from his table. We are the free citizens of democracies, and we own our own minds, and we can take them back if we want to. And I'm conscious that can sound a bit fancy or grandiloquent. I'll give you a very concrete example. of a precedent for this in American history that has improved the attention of every single person listening to your podcast or watching this. I think you're a little bit younger than me, David, but I can just remember it used to be completely normal. It was the standard form that people used leaded gasoline in their petrol, in their cars, right? And a bit before my time, it was completely normal that people painted their homes with leaded paint, right? And it was discovered in the 1920s that this profoundly damaged people's brains, and it particularly damaged children's ability to focus and pay attention. But for years and years, the lead industry funded a kind of pseudo-scientific denialist wing of science that denied this. But by the 1970s, the evidence was completely overwhelming that exposure to lead was profoundly damaging children's brains. And the lead industry funded a whole campaign saying, well, the problem is people just don't, housewives don't dust their homes enough. Encouraging people to dust enough, turns out dusting doesn't deal with lead exposure. So what happened? A movement of ordinary moms, it was overwhelmingly moms, banded together and said, why are we tolerating this? Why are we allowing a for-profit industry to damage our children's brains? This is crazy. We can't permit this. And so they banded together, and it's important to see what they didn't demand. They didn't say, let's ban all paint. They didn't say, let's ban all gasoline. They said, let's ban the specific component that is damaging people, our kids' focus and attention. They succeeded. As a result, the Center for Disease Control says the average American child is 3 to 5 IQ points higher than they would have been had lead not been banned. So that's an example of a collective movement that identified something in the environment that was damaging our attention. Ordinary citizens banded together, fought it and succeeded. So what I go through in the book are these 12 factors that are damaging our focus and attention now, where we've got to follow the example of those moms and get them out of our environment.
In the very limited time we have left, Johan, the 2 to 3 and sometimes 4 hour podcast format has grown quite a bit in the last few years. How does that, I mean, is that related to what you're talking about in that? I mean, listen, it's a different type of focus to listen to a 3 hour podcast, or are the specifics of how people consuming it really where the sort of detail where the devil is and it doesn't really deal with this attention thing?
No, I think it's an example. In the same way that you can see that Whole Foods is a counter movement to the obesity crisis, right? You have an obesity crisis because our food supply system has completely changed. That's profoundly damaging our focus and attention. It's also causing obesity. In fact, has caused obesity for me at several points in my life. And of course, that means that you then get a subsection of the population who are privileged, who can then go to Whole Foods, right? And that's great. Now, we're lucky because long form podcasts are free, so you don't need as much privilege. So I think it's absolutely true. When you create an environment, which is where, you know, the average office worker is switching tasks every 3 minutes, that creates a tremendous hunger for greater depth. And the thing we've lost with attention, this attention crisis, is depth. I would just say to anyone watching and listening, think about anything you've ever achieved in your life that you're proud of. Whether it's starting a business, running a campaign group, being a good parent, learning to play the guitar, whatever it is, that thing that you're proud of required a huge amount of focus and attention. And when focus and attention break down, your ability to solve your problems and achieve your goals also breaks down. And that creates a tremendous hunger for greater depth, greater engagement. And of course, long-form podcasts are a beautiful example of deeper, I mean, I seem to have been on every long-form podcast in the world in the last week, so that's why I've started losing my voice. These deeper conversations are what we're desperate for, in the same way that we're desperate for nutrition in our diets. We just don't know how to get it. So I think you're absolutely right. And I think that analogy with the obesity crisis is really important, because I think we are now with attention where we were with obesity in, say, 1970, right? You were beginning to see the beginnings of a disastrous trend, and people responded by blaming themselves, just buying diet books. And it was a disaster. It didn't work, because it wasn't happening because individuals failed. It was happening because the whole system failed, which is why we've got to deal with the system. We've got to deal with the factors that are destroying our ability to focus and pay attention. And I believe I learned for Stolen Focus exactly how we can do that. I went to places that had done it, from New Zealand to France. We can absolutely win this, but we're going to have to fight for our attention.
The book is Stolen Focus, Why You Can't Pay Attention and How to Think Deeply Again. We've been speaking with the book's author, Johan Hari. Johan, always great having you on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's totally a pleasure, David. I meant to say on my publisher's Tase Me that people can also get the audiobook if they want to from any audiobook site. I'm also meant to say you can get it from good bookstores, but I always feel like saying, well, you can also get it from shitty bookstores if you want to. There's no rule about this, right? But yeah, thank you. It's such a joy to be with you, David. Thanks so much.
One of the things we've talked about on the show for a long time is that there seems to be something sort of constitutional that's lowercase c. I mean, with the constitution of the right, the way the right is, where sort of like satire, parody, and to some degree comedy are just sort of like not working on the right. And so an example of that would be this. There was this old show that was supposed to challenge Jon Stewart's The Daily Show years ago. It was called The Half Hour News Hour. And it just wasn't funny, and it failed very, very quickly. And we've seen a lot of these right-wing comedians just fail to be comedians. And the new, like, least funny man in America now is this guy named Jim Breuer. Now, we've talked about Jim Breuer before. He's become kind of like an anti-vax, laugh at Fauci, laugh at science type of right-wing comedian. And it's like, what does that even mean at this point in time? And he really seems to have kind of lost his grip with reality. There's a new video that was published by the Reawaken America American Faith Tour. He's been going around with this like religious revival kind of tour. And we played a clip of that in the past. And he did a video for them where he's now talking, I guess this is, I don't even know what he's talking about. I guess this is supposed to be a commentary on Joe Rogan and foreign policy, although it's hard to tell what this is. But the right thinks that this is funny, whereas I see a guy who's lost his connection to reality, probably worthy of a psych eval. Take a look at this. I think they think this is funny. Maybe the voices are supposed to be funny.
What happened was people like, hey, what, you know, did you see that? And also I was like, Russia wants to go to war. And people like, do they really want to go to war? Yeah, Russia, you know what? No more mandates, maybe some mandates, put Fauci, you know what?
Like, what is the critique here? Is the critique that there are things in the news? Like, I am not, I don't know what is the point here?
Rogan's a problem. Joe Rogan's a problem. They are losing grip.
The right loves this guy. I'm going to show you a video in a second where they're in hysterics. It's almost like, do you normally watch paint dry to the point where this is entertaining?
But beware, because when you're in power that long, you're not going down without a vicious foam at the mouth battle. And I don't know what that's going to be. I mean, I see it now, what they're trying to do to Joe. This is a psychological war. It is an American war. When the White House says we need to censor a human being that allows conversation, guess what, everyone? You've just been taken over and you're just sitting there taking it. And you can buy all you want that. Oh, whoa. And then when it doesn't sell, they send their stars.
What on earth is this guy talking about? I mean, really, like, if the point of that is to defend Rogan, I don't know that that's very helpful to Rogan, to be perfectly honest. It just seems like the rantings of an unhinged person. Just as a reminder, this was Breuer's in-person performance at this American Faith Reawaken America tour, talking about Fauci and some other things. And if you're watching, you'll see that the crowd is in hysterics. These must be the most sheltered people in the world to find this funny.
You know what a cockatoo is? A cockatoo.
Look at the crowd.
And that's what everyone's become.
Right.
Little cockatoos staring at the screen.
Facts and figures, facts and figures. Dr. Fauci, Dr. Fauci.
Whoa, I guess you're right. Masks must not work based on this routine, right? Now, disclaimer, I'm not saying masks don't work. Just to be clear, I don't want to end up getting in trouble myself.
Trust the science. Trust the science.
Now, as I've said before, he did trust the science when, sadly, his wife needed cancer treatment. And he said, with no hint of irony, we are trusting the science. We're finding the best specialists. We're finding the people who know about this stuff. That's who we're following. We're not following Hannity recommending zinc or, you know, whatever. So he's also a complete and total hypocrite. But the right finds this funny. And that should scare us as much as anything else we see going on right now within that right-wing cultural movement. Okay, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this next story. It's just downright bizarre. Maggie Haberman from The New York Times published a note that was sent to Mar-a-Lago club members last week. Mar-a-Lago is Donald Trump's, one of Donald Trump's clubs, and I guess it's where Donald Trump currently lives down in Florida. Trump sent a note out saying that he was going to be DJing this weekend. And this is a former president. It's a very, very strange thing. Trump is going to be DJing. I don't know what else to say. This note was sent out on Wednesday. Great music will be played during dinner on Friday and Saturday evenings, with President Trump playing the role of disc jockey. The music will be amazing. It will be lots of fun, and we will go until the late evening. For those who will be unable to be seated, the bar will be open for drinks. We look forward to seeing everyone again very soon. President Donald Trump. Like, is this sad in some way? Obviously, it's, listen, there's nothing wrong with a president DJing in principle. But is there something sad about what Trump is now relegated to? We saw that video of him entering the Mar-a-Lago brunch room and asking for applause. And there was sort of like a little bit of applause. Now he's DJing at Mar-a-Lago. It seems it reeks of desperation to just hold any attention from people that you can. And also, I mean, in the same way that Trump doesn't really have friends in the way you and I probably think about what it means to have friends, Trump doesn't really understand or follow popular culture. So it's also kind of hard to imagine Trump picking songs. I mean, it's all downright bizarre, but it is the last attempt to remain relevant during this period between losing the 2020 election and getting involved in 2022 and maybe running again in 2024. But I guess one of the fringe benefits of a membership to Mar-a-Lago, that Trump is now the house DJ on Friday and Saturday nights. Good work if you can get it, I guess I would say. We have a voicemail number, and that number is 219-2-DAVID-P. This may be the most chaotic voicemail we've ever received. This is a guy who I guess has been calling. He says, I haven't gotten back to him. I'm not aware of ever having received a call from this guy, but he repeats just about every recent COVID lie I can remember. There's a kid crying in the background. What sounds like his female partner is yelling things to him to say. This almost is performance art of some kind of avant-garde nature. Let's listen to it together.
David Pac-Man, this is Billy Harrison again. I see you still haven't, I see you still haven't.
So there's the kid in the background. Just chaos.
Responded to my voicemails. Either you're scared or...
I'm not aware of any voicemails. And I obviously, you know, I have 1,000 voicemails to listen to right now. We obviously can't respond.
Just like I said, you spread misinformation and you don't know what to say back to me. Like I said, anything that you say, I can debunk. You spread misinformation, you lie. Masks do not work.
So we have peer-reviewed RCTs. Masks work.
That's a lie. Vaccinations don't work. That's a lie.
Vaccinations do. So is it, well, he sounds linguistically confused. He's saying vaccinations don't work. That's a lie. Anyway, vaccinations obviously work very well. You're 97 times more likely to die of COVID if you're unvaccinated.
The election was stolen. That's true.
The election was not stolen. There's not even evidence that a single state was stolen.
Donald Trump was the greatest president of all time. That's true.
No evidence of that, for sure.
Everything that I could say, I could back up. What about you? Like I said,
it's funny how people think asserting something is backing it up.
Yes. I done gave you my number and everything else. So for me and you to go live on your channel, on your little show, and debate. And I can prove to you that you're bull. And that's all you do is spread misinformation. Lies.
I like the woman in the background yelling lies. And then he says, lies. Yes, that's exactly it. What a chaotic situation, huh?
Yeah, you'll take everybody else's voicemail. Stupid shit about you leaving the country. I don't give a fuck whether you leave or you stay or you.
The person in the background feeding him lines is, I mean, you could, if this was a skit, you could not script it any better.
I mean, oh well. Like I said, all the shit you talk about Trump, instead of playing Trump bingo, why don't you debunk shit that he's saying, nope, that's a lie. This is what really happened.
That's what we do.
You can't. You sit there and play Trump bingo. What about Biden and the Democrats? And you can sit there and say that you're not a Democrat all you want to.
It's quite literally the truth. I've never been a Democrat.
You're a f***ing Democrat.
Oh, okay.
A liberal Democrat. A communist, socialist Democrat.
Meanwhile, the left is like, David, you really should be a socialist. Why aren't you a socialist?
And if you ask me why and ask me the policies like you like to ask everybody else, get me live on your show and I'll make you look stupid about the communists and socialist shit.
I would love it for someone to make me look like a communist. Like the first question would be, tell me one communist policy that I support. Anyway, that guy sounds like he's got a lot going on. I won't deny that it might be actually fun if he called in. So hopefully he will call in during live calls. We're going to talk about what is happening with the Beijing Olympics on today's bonus show. Very low viewership. And also the quarantine hotels are being called quarantine hell. It's crazy what is happening. We will also talk about alcohol returning to flights in the U.S. and concerns among flight attendants groups about it. I would be concerned. We'll talk about all of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Sign up at Join.
WRCT in sound from way out.
Those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! I have been very, very straightforward and blunt with President Putin, both on the phone and in person. We will impose the most severe sanctions that have ever been imposed.
As President Biden threatens to impose sweeping sanctions against Russia if it invades Ukraine, we'll host a debate on the sanctions being considered in Congress. Could they backfire and increase the chances of war? Then Don't Look Up, the hit film, a parable about the climate emergency, has just nabbed 4 Oscar nominations.
This is not real. This is not real. This is not real.
This isn't happening.
Kate, tell me this isn't really happening.
I hear there's something you don't like the looks of.
We discovered a very large comet.
Oh, good for you. It's headed directly towards Earth.
We'll speak to David Sirota. He just was nominated for an Academy Award for the screenplay of Don't Look Up. We'll also look at a major labor victory in Mexico, where GM workers voted to join an independent union. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. High-level diplomatic talks continued Tuesday amidst ongoing tensions on the Russia-Ukraine border. In Kiev, French President Emmanuel Macron signaled some progress during his talks one day earlier with Russian President Vladimir Putin, but the Kremlin quickly rebuffed any claims that Moscow had made any commitments towards de-escalation. Russia's preparing to begin 10 days of military drills in Belarus, with some 30,000 combat troops expected to participate. Meanwhile, Macron, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, and the Polish President Duda put on a unified front against Russia during a joint news conference Tuesday. This is President Macron.
Et nous allons continuer d'agir dans les semaines qui viennent.
We will continue to act in the coming weeks with simple objectives. The first one, it has been said, avoiding war. The peace and stability of the European continent are treasured by us, and we believe our duty is to do whatever is in our power to preserve it.
The European leaders also warned again of wide-reaching consequences if Russia invades Ukraine. President Biden's also threatened to impose sweeping sanctions on Russia after headlines will host a debate on U.S. sanctions being considered by Congress. New York's become the latest Democrat-led state to drop some of its COVID restrictions, lifting its indoor mask or vaccine mandate for businesses starting today. Governor Kathy Hochul has not yet announced the future of New York schools' mask mandate, which is set to expire in 2 weeks. Pfizer announced a projected $32 billion in revenue this year from its publicly funded COVID-19 vaccine. That's just part of Pfizer's overall projected revenue of around $100 billion in 2022, with another $22 billion coming from the sale of its COVID pill, Paxlovid. Pfizer's refused to share its technology with other countries in desperate need of vaccines. Oxfam said in response to Pfizer's financial report, quote, "Thousands of people in Africa are dying every day from COVID because companies like Pfizer have prioritized profits over saving lives. No corporation should decide who lives and who dies," they said. In other vaccine news, Johnson & Johnson's halted production of its coronavirus vaccine. The Dutch plant making the only usable doses of the shot switched over to production of an experimental vaccine unrelated to COVID. The pause, which started at the end of last year, is expected to last a few months. Many African nations, as well as the COVAX distribution program, rely heavily on J&J's one-dose vaccine. Canadian truck drivers protesting COVID restrictions and vaccine mandates temporarily shut down traffic on a bridge linking Canada with the U.S. city of Detroit Tuesday. The action sparked concerns over supply chains for the auto industry if protests continue to grow. The mayor of Ottawa Sunday declared a state of emergency over the so-called Freedom